Hello, Susan Florey, happily with you once more with The Big Middle. We are talking work this time, the now, how, why, and even the what to wear of it through the murky lens of COVID.
None of us know where it's headed. It's an uncertain pattern we're facing. It's an uncertain future. And I think that it's you know, there's a lot of fear out there, but there's also quite a bit of opportunity. I'm seeing some glimmers of hope out there and ways that we're going to shift our workplace and the way we approach our work, but the kinds of opportunities, there are all kinds of new opportunities coming up through this new world that we're facing. And I think of it as kind of work transform.
Carrie Hannon, author, speaker, careers, and personal finance journalist. She taps into the zeitgeist of our rapidly aging roller coaster coronavirus world for the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, PBS Next Avenue, Money, U.S. News and World Report, and so many more. She's called on for comment by major and minor broadcast media, delivers keynotes, writes books, 13 so far. Last year, she gave us Never Too Old to Get Rich, The Entrepreneur's Guide to Starting a Business Midlife, and just out, Great Pajama Jobs, How to Land a Job Without the Commute. Hello, Carrie.
Hello, Susan. It's so great to be with you today.
I think we first made contact, via Richie Eisenberg at PBS Next Avenue more than a year ago, surely.
Without question. And he was actually one of my editors on that book, Never Too Old to Get Rich, and is one of my editors for my column on PBS Next Avenue that also runs on Forbes and MarketWatch. But Rich is just amazing. And he said, you must know, Susan, the two of you are going to really hit it off. So yay, we're here.
Yay, finally. We've been chasing each other around the globe. No, he's such a fantastic guy. Hi, Richie. Now, I've reached you at home. It's kind of late in the day in Washington, D.C. Has it been, you're thinking about your book, The Pajamas Element, has it been a dress up or a dress down workday for you?
Oh, my gosh, this is getting very personal, but this is what I'll tell you. It was it started off as a true pajama day morning, and then I shifted into putting on some blue jeans and heading out to the barn to ride my horse, and now I'm back into my comfy work-from-home clothing.
A horse that you ride in D.C., or you've got a second home in Virginia?
I do, and we have a cottage out there, but he's out in Virginia, about an hour drive from Washington, D.C., a little less, 50 minutes. So I try to get out a couple times a week, and it is my true passion, and it is where I kind of unwind and focus and recharge in order to do all those fun things I do that you listed above for my work.
Well, you are a writing machine in the best sense of that word. You are so prolific. I mean, I'm on Twitter. We follow each other on Twitter, and every 10 seconds I'm thinking, oh boy, she's turned out another article. And they're not sort of flimsy listicles. You dig into some broad subject matter. I want to talk about Great Pajama Jobs. Great cover. It's a sketch of a photo of you relaxing in your gym jams on your sofa with your laptop and a gorgeous yellow lab. What's the name of your dog?
Zena, she's my road manager. She goes everywhere with me.
Seriously, because you run around the United States and the world doing keynotes and things and conferences. Now, that sofa, do you really work from the sofa? Do you sort of cycle around the different rooms of your house to do all of the work you do through your laptop?
Absolutely. Wherever the laptop can go, I go. So I can be, if I'm out at my cottage, I can be on the porch sitting in a lovely chair. I can be on the couch. I can be in the bedroom. I just wander around with my computer. And you know what? That's what makes it so much fun is that you can, for me, it's this sense of autonomy, the sense of freedom. I worked in an office for, you know, over two decades, and I did my time in the office, and I never want to go back to an office. I absolutely love the freedom to work at 5 a.m. if I choose to, or work at midnight if I want to, which is unlikely for me. I'm more of a morning person. But it gives you this sense that you can control where you work, when you work, and how you work. And that is huge. I mean, I'm more productive now than I ever was when I worked in-house. And I often have editors I worked with back at some of these publications going, oh my gosh, Carrie, you used to have trouble getting to the office by 10. You know?
You're talking about me now too. I like pottering in the morning. And you remind me just the other week, the last actual podcast episode I did with Megan Ramos, you know, I'd done the first edit, made sure, and then I did another technical check and I thought, I better just do another pass, make sure there are no sound glitches on the line. And I thought, but man, look at those dandelions. They really need to be pulled up and the tap roots are 100 feet long. And so I got a little one of those shoe bags, those sporting shoe bags, put my laptop, put a sock, made sure that I could go through it and hear it. And so I did the weed pulling with my MacBook on my back. And I thought, I love this. When you work for yourself from home or from wherever, this is the freedom you've got.
Yep. Yep. It's magical. And I think I'm much more creative than I ever was when I worked in-house. Now, there's definitely a role for that. I'm not saying we can talk more about that. I don't think everyone's hardwired to be a great remote worker. But for me, it works at this stage in my life. It's perfect.
I mean, all the commentary that I'm hearing from people in the various news bulletins and radio programs and podcasts is that, you know, it would be everybody loves a couple of days of it and then they want a couple of days in the office. But 4-day work week, that seems to be gaining a lot of traction with people. And yes, 2 days to enjoy my family, be more productive, have the quiet of whatever space I've got at home for the lucky. You know, a lot of people can't do it. I mean, they live in microscopic apartments. They don't have a garden. They have family conditions, family relationships that make it very difficult to be productive at all. But for the people who can find the space and the calm to get a lot done, I think what's emerging is a preference for a hybrid model, 2 days, 3 days at home, a couple of days in the office, and limited commuting.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely spot on there. That is what I see evolving. And for some workers, they may never have to go back. I mean, and for a worker over 50, you might not want to or limit it just until we get this health crisis behind us a bit. But nonetheless, I think that a pairing of the two might just, that there's some great synergy there that I ultimately will be a model moving forward. But there were some, even prior to COVID and all of us being sent home, there was a global movement for remote workers. I mean, remote working has been gaining steam for quite some time because it's really cost effective for employers. And even younger workers, we often think of older workers who really want this sort of flexibility. But younger workers today have been asking for the same thing. They're digital natives. They take their laptops anywhere. They don't feel the need that they need to be in an office as much. And often, even in job interviews, they were asking that as one of their benefits, is how much flexibility. So it was out there, and it's a cost savings. And frankly, I think workers can be a lot more productive. And I think we've found that through this remote, you know, this is the great remote working experiment that we're going through right now. But the genie is truly out of the bottle, that I think there won't be any going back. People aren't going to look back and say, oh, you know, it doesn't work, because companies have found out, yeah, it does work. It can work. And people are, you know, we're getting things done here. And so I think we're going to see a lot more moving forward.
Yeah, as long as corporates consult their employees, because it's not for everyone. A lot of people need, you know, we've got that. What did I hear the other day? There's some sort of app where you can order up a soundtrack of an office and tune into that. If you're finding you need the buzz of the colleagues next door, I would never do that because I absolutely love working from home. But I can see we're all different.
No, you're so right. There's many people who they thrive on the human interaction. They thrive on having coworkers. And you really do, you know, you have to take that extra step if you're a remote worker to make those connections, because those are valuable. And for an employer, Susan, it's really important, because especially when you're onboarding or bringing new people into your workplace, it is at the office where you build loyalty, where you build friendships, and you find a way to connect with the coworkers all bond together, the teams gel together. So there's a role, like, how do you get that if everyone's disconnected? So there's going to be a role for having, especially younger workers. I really, really, and I think you'll back me up on this from your experience, when I was in my 20s and 30s, I wanted to be in the office at least part of the time, because I built relationships there that have lasted a lifetime.
No, absolutely. It was fun. And I know your background. You took comparative literature, a BA in comparative literature at Duke, but you're a native of Pittsburgh, and your first newsroom was back in your hometown. You started as a print reporter in Pittsburgh. Tell us about that start and what it was like. Because I know, because I was in newsrooms too, and the buzz was palpable. You wanted to be there because everything was happening. You know, it was the hub, the excitement hub.
Well, such energy. And you learned from all the people around you. You learned by watching other people doing their jobs, by, you know, the sense of accountability that you have when you're in an office. And I tell you, we bonded. It was like graduate school. You know, when you're there, we're all learning at the same time, like my cohort. But yeah, I went back to Pittsburgh. I had a really great opportunity there where I'm in my 20s and I was covering nightlife for Pittsburgh Magazine. So I would go out and I would profile a jazz musician and say where to go in Pittsburgh for jazz. So I really learned, and I had a great editor there, a guy named Randy Ryland, and I learned how to write profiles. And my entire career, that has been my favorite thing to do, is tell people stories, to talk about their work and how they do it. And I really got that embedded in me back then. And my very first writing jobs, even prior to that, everyone said, write about what you love. And so I knew I wanted to be a writer. I didn't know how the heck I was going to make money at it. But I found a little horse magazine. And I'm passionate about horses. A little horse magazine. I'm 19 years old. And they would let me go interview professional horsemen and women. And I would write a profile. And then they published
it. Wasn't even
it.
Work for you. You just adored doing it.
They paid me like $50. And I'm like, woohoo, I'm rich, you know. And so, but it really, you know, those experiences. And then I started stringing for Business Week and for Advertising Age, and really built out a night working for Pittsburgh Business Times and the Pittsburgh Press. I built out a nice portfolio of work that I did covering small business and all kinds of things. So it's a lot of fun.
Now, fast forward a number of years, what you thought was the capstone of your career. You got a column in a national newspaper with your picture beside it until I was interested to read about you took a walk on a beach in Florida with your dad and everything shifted for you.
I did. Oh, my gosh. You really did your homework. It is so true. You know, I thought my whole life I'd gone to Forbes magazine in New York. It was amazing. U.S. News and World Report. Fantastic. And then I moved over to USA Today. I'd been at Money Magazine also in New York. And USA Today was incredible. I mean, I had a column on taxes and retirement. And I had my picture. And this had been my dream, a national newspaper. And USA Today was huge back then. And I was like, wow, this is so exciting. But, you know, I was miserable.
Why were you miserable? Was it the pressure that I used to feel in the newsroom? Was because it's hurry up and do more yesterday.
Yeah, it was like at 5 o'clock, it's like, what do you have for me? What do you have for me? And I'm like, oh my gosh, I write a column. I want to go walk my dog, you know? And then one day, this is horrible, and anyone in the news business who hears this will probably roll their eyes at me. But they said, Carrie, can you write a column about, it was a news story. It wasn't even for the column. It was just news. The market had been down or something, you know, right? What should people do? Because I wrote news you can use. It was, you know, consumer journalism. And I was like, can't you just run the one I wrote last week? Because it's the exact
same. No, darling, it doesn't work that way.
It's the exact same story, you know? And I was like,
give it a new top, change a couple of words.
My editor looked at me and I'm like, I know, you're not supposed to say that when you work for a daily paper. But I had always been a magazine reporter. And so it was a little bit different. For the most part, my career was in doing magazine pieces.
You went and you wrote a book that was quite far afield from what you normally did after that walk on the beach.
No kidding, I did. And I went, a friend of mine was doing a coffee table book about Navajo weavers. And so the writer who was supposed to do it wigged out on them. And she goes, oh, my friend Carrie can do that, because she knew I love to write people's stories. So we went out to the reservation, and it's the Four Corners where Colorado and New Mexico, Arizona, and so forth, all kind, Utah, all come together. And I was on the Navajo reservation. I profiled these weavers because the women were no longer, or not as much, as kind of a dying art, passing the tools down to their kids because they had been leaving the reservation. And two of the women I profiled didn't even speak English. And I had a Navajo, they spoke Navajo, and I had a translator with me. They lived 45 minutes down a dirt road, this one woman, Mary, no electricity, no running water, a hogan where she raised something like 8 children. And her loom took up almost the entire thing. I mean, it's extraordinary, I thought, in America. And yeah, in America. But Mary was pure joy. Mary absolutely loved her weaving and what she did. And she said, you ask questions nobody thinks about. And I looked around and, you know, Susan, something shifted in me. I realized I brought all my East Coast sensibilities out there. And here was sheer beauty where she lived, where she worked, what she did. She loved what she did. And something fundamentally changed in me and how I approached my work from that moving forward. And I really decided I wanted to explore work and why people do what they do and what the magic is in the creativity and what drives them.
And you wanted the autonomy of controlling your own work life.
I never look back. Yeah, never
Fantastic.
Look back. But in retrospect, Susan, now quickly, just as a couch is on the cover of my book, psychology, is I realized many, many, many years later, it had nothing to do with the newsroom. It had everything to do with me. It just created so much anxiety for me because I wasn't used to having people all around me and having these deadlines and all the noise, and you couldn't even, everyone could hear everything you were saying. It was me, it wasn't them. And I realized that it just wasn't the right work environment for me, although I loved the work.
Yeah, and that was even, and I don't want to keep going too far down this track, but I mean, that was even the glory days as well. I mean, in broadcasting, you used to have your own desk. And then when I was doing it in the 2000s at Reuters, you were hot desking. You felt like a potted plant being moved around this stressy environment full of noise. And, you know, the signal to noise ratio was off the charts. But let's get back to the now. We can only guess at the long-term impacts of COVID, what the most painful pain points are going to be. You are so well positioned to look at the broad sweep of what's going on. Millions of all ages are finding themselves surplus to purpose, and millions more are going to be joining those ranks when the government wage subsidies end in just a few weeks. Do you have any idea of whether they're going to be extending some of that relief or not?
Well, I think it's been pushed down to the states to try to do some of that here, and that's sort of slowly moving forward. And the hope would be yes, but the point is that you're making is things have shifted, and the workplace isn't going to go back to how it was. It will not. And again, like in 08, we've seen a big seismic shift in people losing jobs and industries leaving. I mean, there are a lot of industries that aren't going to come back from this in any timely fashion. And older workers over 50, have taken a particularly hard slam from this. Now they're starting to regain some traction, but they often were some of the first people to be laid off in the spring of this year. And I think that's a global thing that we've seen happen. Some of it because of salary. You know, if they had to cut back, why not start trimming from those, the people who earn the most, kind of thing. But it has to do with industries you work in as well. But when older workers try to get back into the job market, it always takes longer than it does for younger workers. But it's not impossible. What it requires, though, Susan, is people have to be more creative about thinking about the kind of work they're going to do and how they can redeploy their skill set into other fields, under industries. And that takes a lot of soul searching, and it's not an easy task to do your MRI on your skill set. And also, you're going to have to stay up to speed. You can't just coast anymore. You have got to learning now, while we're still at home, is a great time to step up those skills. And really, you have to be relevant.
But once you've done all that, you know, we can talk about tips and tricks for the older unemployed. There's all kinds of good information out there, and great information and inspirational and practical advice in your books. But isn't it the smaller piece of the issue? Because many over 60s, they are at higher risk now of a bad outcome if they catch COVID. So that's going to be a factor. And the structural and cultural change needs to happen at a much faster clip if we're going to keep the pre-pandemic gains that we saw in over 50s employment, because the over 50s have been getting jobs. They might not be high wage jobs. They might be much lower wage jobs than said person is used to. But isn't sort of the tips and the tricks the smaller piece of it? We need to really find the lever that is going to change the narrative, the cultural narrative that is, old people, they just need to shove along. And yeah. Everybody forgets that we're not making the graduates, we're not making the babies that are going to fill all the available jobs.
Correct. And I love that you brought this up, because that really is, it is a cultural issue. I mean, we can talk about ageism till our, you know, we both are spinning our heads around. This has not changed. This is pervasive. It has been part of our culture, our work culture, our social culture for decades and decades and decades. And it's so entrenched that it's extraordinary. So it requires this sort of, and the thing is that the message I want to get out to people, and I think you do too, is it's not, we're not talking about this for our age cohort. And as I say, I'm 59. I'm thinking of my nieces in their 20s, because what we do today is it going to impact what their work life is going to look like as well, because everyone is going to be living longer lives. Longevity is here to stay. It's not a career that ends at 65. You have multiple careers. And so we have to rethink how work gets done and how you build in. And we, you know, you've seen the studies that, you know, the two generations, three multi-generational workforces and teams are more productive. I mean,
yeah,
they
absolutely.
Two work really well together. There's not a war of the ages. It makes me crazy when people say that, because frankly, I don't see it that much. That's sort of a made up myth that the younger workers are bitter that the older workers haven't left the work. But there's that cultural norm that people think that is the case, when I think there's a lot of more positive stories we're seeing there. But we have to convince employers that, yeah, we almost were there when the job market was tight, right? Because they weren't able to find.
Exactly.
Now the job market in the last, you know, 6 months is quite different. So it's going to take some treading to get this back. But again, maybe employers started to get a glimmer of why they need, you know, that they're not having these younger workers coming up. And plus, they don't have the same skill sets or experience that you get from somebody older. But that made up age of retiring at 65 is just, it really is not going to exist moving forward. And this, we're maybe the last generation that even thinks it is.
And the thing is too, we've got all these assumptions that you must have a golden honeypot if you're over 60, you know, and what's wrong with you if you don't. And you know, that's the preserve of our parents when we had final salary pensions. It's not our generation. You know, it's tough out there for young, middle, and old. My biggest mission with this podcast, and I know you share it, Carrie, is to sensitize people of all ages to the reality that the 1950s Leave It to Beaver life model is obsolete. The kids of now need to know an earning window of, say, 25 through 55 is not going to be near enough to sustain you through your 60s and beyond.
Oh, absolutely. And that's so important. It's so critical what you're saying here. Because actually the 20-somethings are having a hard time in the job market, as are the 50-plus ed. I mean, it is, both groups are having a hard time. I think there's this theory, too, that we need to think, and someone you've had on your program, on your show before, Mark Friedman, always says, you know, at 60, you can have another whole other 15 years or 20 years ahead of you to have a whole other second career doing something completely different than you did before. I mean, it's you're just beginning over again. There's this whole thing that people don't understand. But the biggest issue is, and the biggest fear I have, is elder poverty. And I think this is something, because people have not been able to plan accordingly. They didn't understand as they took control of their own, a lot of their own retirement planning. But one of the big issues that I think we're going to see globally is, and we alluded to this earlier, is contract work. I think coming out of this COVID is that we're going to see more employers unwilling to do the full freight where they're paying all these benefits and so forth, but they're happy to hire you on a contract basis. And this has already been happening for people in their 20s I interview these especially women, because I write a lot about women and money, and they're working contract jobs. They don't have retirement benefits. They're really not saving, you know, and especially in their 20s, women still spend money on marketing themselves to find a spouse or a partner, which is ridiculous, but it's true. I have this fear that generation is really not on board with how going forward, these jobs with great benefits are really going to be, you know, very few and far between, in my opinion.
What's your position, Carrie, on longer term guarantee schemes and universal basic income? Maybe that's what we need, sort of a hybrid model of those two, to see us through what we can't really lowball as a crisis. This is a global reset of staggering magnitude. And clearly, if the jobs aren't there, the tips and tricks are not going to help anyone. We need to maybe create the work. I mean, depending on what happens in November, if the Democrats win, we might see the Green New Deal, and there'll be some green jobs. But where else will the jobs be? And maybe we need some state support.
You know, I absolutely love that idea and that concept. And I do think, you know, in great periods in this country with, you know, obviously with the Depression, that was a way that when you had the works program that really did get people back to work. And if there is a way to do something that would provide, there's so many things that need to get done in infrastructure and many, many levels of jobs that, that there's a real need out there for these people who can do these kinds of jobs. But the point is, I am so cynical about the ability to get anything passed through and get employers on board with something. With there's so many in the U.S. that we have such a high debt as it is. It's just hard to imagine being able to push something through that would actually provide this kind of opportunity for people. I sincerely hope, because we do need a cushion. There is definitely a need for education, for workplace education, for retraining for jobs, and for new jobs, and encourage employers to do that. And I find that, you know, these are all great ideas on paper, but it's really trying where the rubber meets the road kind of thing. I'd love to hear your take on that, though, briefly.
Well, you know, for me, I'm just worried about civil unrest. If people can't feed their kids, and we've got the small businesses that are going out of business, you've got the Silicon Valley giants who are banking it, and yeah, we've got this, the rest of society struggling, uncertain, starting to have mental health and well-being issues, you know, settling into this lockdown rhythm, and should I be afraid of the virus, or should I just go forth and take public transport and wear my mask? I worry about violence in the streets, because people can only take so much. These government subsidies and interventions, I think, are going to have to be like they're doing in Germany. They're going to have to be for a two-year plan. People are going to have to be given a sense of, okay, I'm going to be covered. I might not be raking it in like I was before in the pre-COVID world, but at least I can feed my children. I can keep the roof over my head. And maybe this is the reset that we all need anyway, to slow down and savor the simple pleasures in life.
Yeah,
I think
I love that.
We need a lot of this. I'm a big believer in Carl Honoré, one of my guests. He's known as the guru of slow. And, yeah, you know, I know from working from home, yeah, I saved a spider who a size of a dinner plate in the bathtub the other day.
Yeah.
And I thought, man, if I had to be suited and booted and throwing the makeup on for television news, I would have had to do something a little bit rougher maybe with that spider. But no, I took the 10 minutes it took to go and get the broom and carefully encourage him to jump on and then put him out in a plant. I felt good all day for saving
that feel great?
Massive spider.
I do that all the time. I liberate them. Like not even it's spiders or it's moths or any, especially out in my little cottage in the country. I have this great, I love to save them and release them to the wild.
No, and you don't have time to do that
don't.
If you're
you
jumping on the bus or on the train for the commute and going 90 miles an hour, you know, TV news and print news especially, but all kinds of sectors. You know, we've made ourselves too busy to even know ourselves properly, and we only get one kick at the can. So that's my take on it. And I do worry that if we don't have some sort of real support, worthwhile support for people. People aren't feckless. They're not lazy. They do get a lot of joy out of having the social relationships that they get from work. And yeah, that's my take.
I think they do. And to be slightly contrarian, though, I think that that's true. And I think that it's a matter of refocusing what's important to us. But it's also what kinds of work we're willing to do. And I know in this a lot of people don't want to do certain kinds of jobs, you know, and, you know, I mean, if I were to go back to my example of going to the barn, you know, it's really hard to get people who want to work in the barn and do barn work. Now, I'm not saying that you know, if you're a white collar worker, you want to go muck stalls and groom horses and be there at 5:30 or 6 in the morning. But there's all kinds of jobs that people have gotten the idea, or even it's basic trade jobs. I mean, my gosh, you know, I have a broken refrigerator. Trying to find somebody to come and fix something is so hard these days. They're great, important jobs in the trades that people think, oh, I need to have a college education. I have to have this kind of office, this kind of job that pays, you know, where there's a whole level of jobs that there's a huge demand for, you know, basic tradesmanship and craftsmanship and caring for animals and working on farms and garden, you know.
And these are the things we value. And we found that with the key workers and the essential workers, you know, clapping them in New York City. And I don't know if that stretched out across the rest of the country. Were you clapping the key workers in D.C. as well?
No, but I loved watching hearing and watching the New York ones. Yeah.
Yeah. And we did it for the essential workers, the NHS people. And then it sort of grew to expand to take in kind of not as much as it should have, but the cashiers at the supermarkets and the bus drivers. And you know, it's only lasted for as much as it's lasted. So, I mean, they all need to be paid better. We need to reassess our values.
Yes,
it's so funny.
Caregiving jobs. I mean, my mom's 90. And we've been caregiving for her because we took her out of her assisted living place because she could never have survived under lockdown and isolation. But those men and women who do those caregiving jobs, they're not paid enough. And there's a huge demand. And I think that's globally for these kinds of jobs. And people don't go into those fields because it's hard work. And they're not paid well, you know, in many cases, not across. I'm sure there are. But, you know, $15 an hour is not a lot of money.
But we need the radical progressives to start being in positions where they have leverage, they have power. I don't mind putting my politics out there because anyone who follows me on Twitter knows. I mean, everything crossed for the Dems in November. So hopefully we can see some change there.
Yeah.
And but for the jobs, we've also got AI taking over. I was just listening to Tim Ferriss's latest guest his podcast. He had the technologist Kevin Rose on, and they were talking in acronyms I didn't understand. I had to, you know, hit Google to look at them, but they were talking about a new API, an application programming interface from an outfit calling itself OpenAI. And it's kind of like Siri, Alexa. You can say to this software, you can say, okay, this is a really cool website. Give them the example. And then you can maybe find another one, give an example. Then you can ask this software to make the same for you. And apparently it spits out one that's really glorious with the features you want in mere minutes. So you think about this is now. So do we as a society lap up all of these technological innovations? Or do we put the brakes on and say, okay, how many graphic designers, how many web designers, how many layers of humanity does this shove to the sidelines? Because it's going to replace their jobs if we really start doing these things at scale.
But I think there are jobs coming up that we don't even know about to care for the aging workplace and for the aging population. I mean, I think that we have people in there, you know, and I've talked about this in some of my other books, Great Jobs for Everyone 50 Plus, is these jobs to ride the age wave. I mean, people in their 50s and 60s doing jobs for, you know, to services and products for people in their 70s and their 80s and beyond. And these are jobs we didn't even know about 10 years ago, some of them. So I think we're going to see more because the human touch is not going to go away when it comes for caring for an aging population. And there are going to be need for people to do these kinds of jobs. I mean, the simple ones in my Great Jobs book, and I think I may have even stolen that phrase from our friend Mark Friedman, but the thing is, you know, is things like, you know, senior massage therapist or senior fitness instructor or home remodification pro, somebody who can come in and you know, retrofit your home so you can age in place, patient advocate. I mean, there's these jobs, people weren't really doing those jobs 10 years ago. And then all of a sudden it's like, yeah, you know, this is really viable. I mean, I hire somebody.
But viable, but if here it's £10 an hour. You can't feed a family on £10 an hour, 8 hours, and then get taxed at 20%. I mean, these are smock jobs. You know, we need to, the companion piece would be to increase the value, the monetary value that we attach to these roles.
But I think a massage therapist is making $100, at least in the U.S., they make $100. You know, for an hour massage. I mean, you could build that in. You do have to get training. So they're not all, but I do think that we could think deeper about what are some of these important jobs and find a way to value them more. You can get more, when I talked about the nursing assistants or the caregiving, the RNs and, you know, the whole healthcare field has promising opportunities for people. We just have to figure out what are those angles going to be. But you're correct. You're not going to make a living. You know, the pay isn't great. And again, you might be on a contract basis and so forth. But I do think there are new jobs coming on the board all the time that do require the human touch.
Yeah. So, well, hopefully we'll see those. Yeah. I was thinking actually earlier after listening to that episode of the Tim Ferriss Show, you know, that made at home with human hands. That could be the only luxury label. you know, the only one that's accorded any cachet in society.
Well, and you know, to segue quickly back to my book from last year, Never Too Old to Get Rich, which, you know, really is a book about, you know, I want everyone to get rich, but it's about at midlife, you know, turning to do something you maybe always wanted to do. And it's the richness of doing work with meaning and work that you want to do. And again, in your situation, what you mentioned earlier, it may not always be about becoming a super wealthy person from doing this, but you make enough to get by. You make enough to feed your family. You make enough to really love what you're doing and have a, it gives your life meaning. And some of these entrepreneurs that I profiled, a lot of this happened when I did my What's Next book as well. It was people coming out of 08, 09 recession, at the older over 50 set, who couldn't find work. And they just got so fed up with the rejections and the ageism and the all of the stuff that went into that, getting right down the line and almost getting hired, but not, you know, somebody younger would get the job or whatever it would be. They say, you know, what the heck? I'm just going to do my own thing. I've always wanted to do this. And it might be being a consultant. It might be doing something completely, you know, really starting something from scratch. But you know, a small nonprofit or all of these businesses I profiled, I thought were really fun, interesting. And the truth is, I only profile winners because I think that's who we learn from. But they were a smorgasbord of types of work. And I do think we're going to see more entrepreneurship coming out of this pandemic because people will be feel stuck and say, you know, I've got to earn some money. I've got to get
started. It's by default as well, but it's a choice. And I love the people you profiled in your book, Never Too Old to Get Rich. And and it very much brings to the fore the Encore.org ethos. Mark Friedman, I had the founder of Encore on, and Vice President Marcy Alberher in two separate episodes. And so if you can find that career that fires you up in the morning, gets you out of bed with a sense of purpose and drive and something you want to do, but also gives you autonomy, that is fantastic. I'd love you to just bring us a couple of those stories, because you profiled 20 entrepreneurs. Some of them had the social aspect. You did a whole chapter, if I'm recalling right, on social entrepreneurs.
Right, a whole section on social
entrepreneurs. I love the story. Yeah. Even if you just give us the one, Jamal Joseph, the Hope for Harlem chapter. So good.
Yeah, Jamal was incredible. And, you know, he's got a pretty deep backstory in terms of early life, having spent some time in prison because of the Black Panthers and really studying during that time and learning about the theater and becoming a playwright and so forth. And he really came out of there and became a very, had a very successful career post that period of his life. But for him, he's a professor at Columbia now, Columbia University in New York, but he lived in Harlem, and he just you know witnessed this scene over and over again of young people losing their life through violence in the city, and mothers gathered together trying to make sense of it all. And he said, you know, now today Harlem has gotten quite gentrified, so this was in parts of it. But Jamal said, you know, I can make a difference in these young people's lives. And he put together an after school program that was very rigorous and was, and it's still, you know, just going tremendously well, and able to, you know, give these kids a place to go to learn to perform. But they had to keep their grades up. They had accountability on many levels, and they do have it. And it's just been a great successful model in New York that he's done. And you know, there's all kinds of things like that people can give back to. And I also, you know, there's a woman I profile who she is a psychotherapy, she's a therapist, and she had a lot of women coming to her, and they were, you know, complaining about depression and this and that, and they were taking all kinds of medication. And she started getting curious about the mind and the gut connection and what we eat and how we feel and all these things. And she started studying and taking courses and going to conferences and experimenting with making these great juices and stuff. And you know what? She started with a younger person who was helping her initially, but then she moved on her own. And she started a series of these juiceries in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that have been hugely successful, Salad Juicery. And it's all about these good, healthy, natural drinks that are good for you. And so she still sees her clients, but this is a business that's been thriving. But it came from a curiosity she had that stemmed from her primary career. But you know, we see all kinds of great stories of people who reach back. And one section of the book, Susan, I like a lot, are these intergenerational opportunities. And this one,
Oh, the mom and daughter with the cookies.
Yeah, one hot cookie. You know, I just love it, this mother and daughter. And she was a single mom, and she's raising her daughter. And they like to make, the mom, you know, Bergen had a full-time job. But she was, you know, looking for something new. And she was, you know, it wasn't as secure as she had hoped. And she and her daughter, they like to make cookies together. And then they started, you know, sharing them with friends and family. And one thing led to another. And they opened, you know, they ended up opening a shop, you know, one hot cookie in Youngstown, Ohio. And it's taken off. Now they have another donut one now. Now, believe me, Bergen got hit really hard by COVID, right? Because she had not personally ill, but they had to shut down a lot for a while and really scrambled. And you know, trying to get their legs back under them and do curbside pickup and all that. And they're coming back. But they had, you know, expanded to doing, you know, moving into franchising and stuff. So, but again, there's models if you do baby steps and start slow. And I do think they're, and the daughter works with her in the business still, and they're doing quite well. But you know, there's stories all along. I was thinking of, you know, there's a father-in-law and a son-in-law. The son-in-law had you know, it was in his 20s, late 20s, looking for work, and the father had just retired from a lawyer at Verizon, the phone company, and they started a gin company, Green Hat Gin, and they built this up working together. And so, I mean, there's all kinds of
what a labor
things.
Of love that would
yeah.
be to work with your mom or your dad,
yeah.
Making something, not knowing how it's going to grow this way or that, or even if it's going to take. I think that's incredibly exciting.
And as you and I know from the work you've done, the combination of where you have the experience and the sort of resilience, where that word gets overused, but of an individual who's seen setbacks, has gotten through things, but understands marketing and project management of the senior person in that role, and the younger person who has, you know, fresh ideas, perhaps, not that the older one doesn't as well, but it brings this new enthusiasm to something, or has the marketing chops. So we were just talking about technology. They understand that you need to be on Pinterest, or you need to be on Instagram, that you need to market in a different way than one used to. And it's not expensive to start your own business these days, because we can do it on our laptops or on our home computers without bricks and mortar. And you can test the waters. There are ways to start in baby steps without $50,000. You can start with $5,000 and see, or maybe less than that. And just
technology has just opened up the world for all of us. And now that everything with the pandemic moved online, I'm curious, did you write this book before, or did you start writing it 2 minutes after we locked down?
Oh, well, thank you for asking. I actually started this book last summer because I saw the global movement of people, you know, of companies starting to get it, to understand the benefit of having remote workers. The people, my cohort, who I write to a lot, the over 50 set, was really asking for more flexibility in their work. And then I was talking to nieces and nephews who wanted it. I'm like, and then FlexJobs, Sarah Sutton, who's just lovely, who started this business, this job board remote, FlexJobs.com and Remote.co are two of her websites. She and I paired up and I started talking to her. And, you know, I realized that there were some great jobs out there for people. And I thought, let's write about this trend, this global movement, because a lot of studies were starting to come out and Gallup had been looking at this. So I was well underway and nearly done. I was about to send my manuscript off to my publisher, Wiley, and the first week of March, I guess it was.
And I thought, knowing you and how speedy you are, you kind of light bulb went on, you know, everyone's buying pajamas because we're locking down for who knows how long. So, and I just admired you so much, but I still admire you for getting on the pulse of the problem.
But Wiley was great. They said, hey, take a little more time and dig back. Let's make this current. Let's find out what's really going on. So lucky for me, it hadn't sent off to the printer. So I was able to, you know, jump back in and get a fresh perspective on what we're seeing and what we're likely to see. But as you and I, as we said at the talk, you know, it really is a crystal ball, and we don't have it.
No, we don't. None of us have it. But what will we learn? What will we learn from what you call Carrie's Great Pajama Jobs Workshop?
Well, you're going to learn a couple of things. The most important thing is that, again, you need to, if you're going to succeed, and there really truly are a smorgasbord of remote jobs out there for people. And it's not just because they have to be remote. Moving forward, they can be remote. But you can now say to somebody, if you want to be a remote worker or work from home, hey, I have experience at doing this. I have a track record of this. I can show you that I completed my assignments on time or my project came in ahead of time. There are a couple of really key ingredients to being able to succeed at this. And you need to really have discipline. You need to be able to draw boundaries between your work and your private life. And there, you have to be clear about those to your friends, to your family, to your employer, because otherwise you're going to work, and it's going to, or you'll be under so much stress. So you have to find a way to really get disciplined. You have to become a great communicator. If you weren't before, you have to be today. You need to pick up the phone. Stop sending emails and texts all the time. Your boss, your manager needs to hear your voice, and you need to set, and your friends and colleagues and your workers, teammates, you need video. You need to, the Zooms of the world are going to be out there. And it's important to have these touch points, everyday communication with your boss because, and your coworkers, because the biggest problem is trust. And if your teammates don't think you're pulling it, your weight, if they think you're slacking, if your boss doesn't think you're getting your projects done, you're meeting deadlines, you're going to be sunk and everyone will lose. So it's really being...
So the accountability aspect has to be there. But are you completely disciplined? I mean, do you have this ironclad structure up at 6 and gym gear on, do your exercise so you can be sparky and carry, and then what? Buckle down and quit in time 6? Or is it more fluid?
Yeah, for me, it's a little different because I work for myself, right? So I don't have one employer who's likely to be checking to see if I'm logged on to their computer system, right? Yeah. So, but I technically, for me to be a good worker, I get up every day at 5:30. And that's just what I do. And I work every single day. But
when do you go to bed, by the way? Because I'm such a night owl.
Yeah. See, that's the thing is I'm okay with that. I don't need to go. I've got the old jammies on by, 9:30 and it lights out at 10. So, because I really, now my husband's the complete opposite. So that's probably why our marriage is going well. Cause we don't see too much. Sorry, Cliff.
Ships in the night, going to the barn again on the horse. Gotcha.
But that's the thing is I can take those breaks during the day and go walk Xena, or I can go meet someone for coffee. I set my own schedule and I love that. So mine's a little bit different, but if you're working for one employer, you probably need to be quite clear about what your working hours are. Right now, we just talked about our friend Rich Eisenberg, and who's one of my editors. Well, he and I will be working on Sunday mornings, sending emails or emails back and forth. So, but I understand he's working from home too, and he has been before that. So we understand each other's work schedule. But I do think you need to be clear about what that is. You need to take self-care. You have to remember to eat. You need to.
And you have to take a break from social media, I think. I mean, I don't have any of the apps anymore on my phone. I refuse to be a prisoner to, I need to be on Twitter. I don't spend much time. I put the podcast up on Facebook, but don't really monitor a site. And I refuse to get drawn in 17 directions and feel the tug of the social media leash all day long.
Yeah,
I don't think it's healthy.
You go down the rabbit hole and it makes you anxious and who knows, you don't need it. I do my social media first thing in the morning. I kind of click through my different things. I try to use that and I read my newspapers in the morning. I do all of that at the front end of the day before I jump into actually writing or reporting or researching and all of that.
Do you give yourself a hard stop?
I try to say
9 o'clock, 5:30 until 9 is coffee, get ready, get energized. And then email cutoff time is what? 8:39.
Surprisingly, you're pretty close on that. Now, I am good about returning emails, though, pretty promptly because I get, and you probably do too, I get a lot of emails. And if I don't respond right away, it moves down the list and I don't want to not respond right promptly. So I try to get back to people really quickly. But the other things, the social media, the Facebooks, the Twitter, the LinkedIn, that's a very select time. And my reading, my newspapers, get through some pretty quickly online, the digital versions, do that in the morning. And I'll circle back at the end of the day on some of those. But it's important. And so it's self-care. It's doing those things. It's really making time for yourself and so that you can really do be a productive worker and a good worker. But you need to take the time to learn time management, which is just what you're getting at. I know what rhythms work for me. And people will discover what works for them.
And you've got to carve out the exercise time or you're sunk.
Oh, Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's really critical. And I know you don't, I have to say this really quickly, is that I have this Carrie's Fitness program that I'm kind of high on for everything in life, but certainly during this time of thinking about looking for work, if you're over 50 and lost your job during this coronavirus period, or changing careers, shifting to something new as you look for new work, is you need to be, you know, financially fit, the best you can do, you know, do a budget. Where can you get lean? I mean, all of us hate to do budgets. Do it. Find out what you can do to downsize, anything you can do so that you're not so dependent on a certain salary in order to pay the mortgage, to pay the rent, whatever it may be. If you can find ways to trim, this is the time to do it. You need to be physically fit. You need to, you know, walk. I walk Zena, but you need to walk your dog, go swim, walk 20 minutes a day, run, whatever it is that works for you. It does wonders for fighting ageism. People want your energy. They want what you have. It has nothing to do with gray hair or wrinkles or whatever. It's this can-do spirit, positivity. That
if you sparkle, they want you. If you engage with them, I mean, you emit a certain energy that everybody wants a little piece of that.
Yeah, they don't even know what that's at. I want her on my team. I want her to, so that or him. And the third piece is you need to be spiritually fit. And I don't mean, you know, woo-woo religion kind of thing, but have a practice, you know, mindful meditation, Tai Chi, yoga. So, again, I get it from walking Zena, but if you out in nature, but if you have a place you can go that just calm the heck down, you know, that centers you, that's just you, and you can find a quiet space, because we all need that. So those are my magic pieces.
Fantastic. I just have a couple more questions because we've been talking for an hour and a half now. This is actually launch day. We're talking on Tuesday. Yeah. Tuesday, the 20, what is it? Oh God, I need my 25th. Specs on. Is it the 25th?
Yeah.
Looks like a six to me. 25th. Squinting to see that on the 25th. And this is the day of the launch, of the formal launch of your book. You can buy it now online, various websites. Have you already started on book 14?
Oh my gosh. You know, Susan, that's really, really a nasty question. You know,
I'm just wondering.
You know,
I'm betting. I think I'm going to lay some money down between you and me. And now I know the answer. You have, haven't you?
I have. I mean, I should be today going, woohoo, I got a book published today. Yay. And I'm saying, oh, I just signed a contract on Friday for my next book, which will be out next year. And it'll be looking at this topic that you and I are talking about. So I can't wait to come back and talk to you again. Hopefully you'll invite me. And the book is roughly titled Work Transformed. So we're really looking at, whoa, what is the new workplace? What is what? And again, I'm not going to have any of the great answers, but I'm going to talk to some great minds and try to find out what it is that we can expect. How can we be prepared? How can we really take advantage of this new reality and not be anxious and bitter and blame everybody, but be proactive and say, okay, this is what's happening. This is where I fit in and how I can, you know, take charge of my own life. And my publisher on that is McGraw-Hill, and I'm really excited to be partnering with them on that.
Chapeau. Well done. I just knew what your answer would be. Now, last question, because we're getting to know you. I love this because I'm getting to know Carrie Hannon, the person, because I know you're writing so well because I read all of your output without fail. What would you do, Carrie, to make money tomorrow if for some reason you couldn't write?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think it's okay. I would, if I couldn't write, I would probably do something with the animals and with horses, because that's my true love. Is I find my solace and my strength through animals. And I don't think I'd want to be a riding instructor. I mean, I've been riding since I was 6 years old. I compete.
Do you do dressage?
I jump. Yeah, I do show jumping. Wow. And so that's really, but dressage, of course, is the base of all of it. And, I would do something tangentially related to the horse world, because I know that world. I know the people. I know it might even be a retail business of some sort, but something that was related to that world of horses and could be dogs, but I have a sense I would move towards horses.
A sanctuary.
Oh, yeah.
Or horses.
I mean, there's so many
horses that maybe have been maltreated.
Yeah. And because horses don't have good endings because people, they're expensive. And as they get older, people, don't understand that they've made an obligation to these animals.
Our values need to be corrected smartly. Yep. Listen, yep. Carrie, thank you so much. You are a one-woman whirlwind of practical advice on crushing the world of work, especially for those of us in the big middle. I cannot thank you enough for coming on. It's only taken us a year to connect, but lovely connection. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
You will, of course, find links to Carrie Hannon's website, her latest books, columns, and keynotes in the show notes. That is it for this week. But before I go, big thanks to Tess, Anna, Mary, and the sign-off says, Atina Tinati of Switzerland, for your lovely reviews. I have put them on the reviews page of my website, susanflory.com. Thanks, too, for all your emails appreciating my chat with Megan Ramos last time out about fasting and cutting the garbage. I will indeed bring you more episodes on health matters of all sorts. I am on it. Do send your recommendations along to susan@susanflory.com. Final thank you for choosing to listen to this podcast over oh so many others. Here's to choosing, too, to stay sunny side up if you can out there. Until next time, bye-bye.